Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live from east of Charlotte, North Carolina. This is where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear, you will be safely traveling with us. Interesting, we were just discussing webcast radio a few minutes ago, and even during the week. And what a wonderful phenomenon it has been. We came on the air 8 years ago with BBS Radio Network, now the world's largest webcast radio network. And look how it's grown. Look how people have come to the internet on their schedule, their time. That's one thing to have news 24 hours a day. You can flip on and in 30, 40 minutes you can catch up on the news of the day. But it's another to just flip on your smartphone or your laptop or your iPad or whatever kind of tablet you have and tap into the news anytime you want. Listen to commentary and to scientists like myself who might analyze what's going on in the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. By the way, I appreciate so much the mail that we've been getting. Really, really fine stuff. Last week, you know, we had Diana West on the program, author of American Betrayal. Really amazing author and amazing book. And your response to that interview, both on her website and at X Squared Radio, has just been nothing short of phenomenal. I see that book going to number one on Amazon and maybe even the New York Times bestseller list. It really rewrites history, which is kind of why we're here. This is where the past meets the future, and we analyze that and we bring that to you. We want you to be part of the program. I know if you're just tuning in now, this is a live program for 3 hours every Sunday evening, and you can call in at 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America, free. If you can get near a cell phone tower anywhere in the world, it's 530-413-9537, 530-413-9537. BBS Radio is also very innovative in that they provide a conference line, which is 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000, and then the passcode 769608 pound. That will allow you to listen using your smartphone, listen to the program. Now, you won't be able to interact. You'll have to call in to make a comment, but you can listen to the program. Put that in your speed dial, and you can get into BBS Radio Channel 2 anytime, but particularly on Sunday evenings from 5 to 8 Pacific Time, 8 to 11 Eastern Time. We're right here live, and we'll be happy to accept your call on almost any subject. We would also like you to visit one of our great sponsors, make a great investment by investing in food. Yes, visit the Food Investor. Just click on the banner on the right-hand side. Also, prepare yourself for this October for an energy revolution at the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference, October 10th in Boulder, Colorado. Promise that we are going to have technology there, not only electric vehicles, electric trucks, vans, all kinds of energy generation, conservation, and collection systems that you can see. And it is rumored, and I'm not sure who's starting the rumor, it might be me, that the world premiere for the trailer for the movie Atlas Shrugged 3 is going to be aired at that conference. So if you're into that movie, you're into the whole phenomenon that is the alternative energy society, affectionately known as Galt's Gulch, come on out. to the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. You can find the link right in the center of the page at X Squared Radio, x2-radio.com. If you have any questions about that or any of the content on this program, you can write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, and I will write you back. Might take me a few days, but I promise you I will write you back. If you would like the printed program notes for any of my programs here at X Squared Radio, you can also write me. I'll be happy to send those to you. They're typically between 25 and 45 pages. Often I do not get to it all because of your comments or because of some extraneous thing I might pontificate on while reading the news to you. The solar wind has settled down from its blistering 700 plus kilometers per second last week. It's settled down to 354 kilometers a second, but there's one sunspot on the sun today, harboring a little M-class flares. Nothing to be really worried about. Keep in mind that many solar physicists don't really know everything about the sun. They have their own area of specialty. But one thing is becoming more and more evident as time goes on is that the Earth needs solar flares. Our atmosphere is actually rebuilt by solar flares. Certainly, we wouldn't like to see one as strong as the Carrington event, but the ions that make up the ionosphere, the highly charged particles that make up layers of our Van Allen radiation belts that help protect our planet from all kinds of high frequency or high velocity particles and radiation is built up by solar flares. So we need those high energy particles coming from the sun. Hopefully we don't see them at 700 kilometers a second, but we need them. The proton count, however, today is one of the highest I have ever seen. It's at 10.9 protons per cubic centimeter. Normally it's somewhere around 1 or 0.7. So be careful if you go out there sunbathing today. Don't expose your skin directly too much. Protons can be easily blocked by ordinary clothing. NOAA estimates a 60% chance of polar geomagnetic storms today. When a coronal mass ejection is expected to deliver a glancing blow to Earth's magnetic field. High-latitude sky watchers should be alert for auroras, so get your cameras ready. I learned recently that noctilucent clouds, you know, those NLCs we have talked about from time to time on the planet, very high altitude, they show up, bluish in color, usually a couple of hours after sunset, actually began with the eruption of Krakatoa and have been with us ever since. High-latitude sky watchers should be alert for NLCs in the evenings ahead. In recent years, they have been sighted as far south as, I know this is really hard to believe, but Utah, Colorado, Nebraska. That's significantly north of here, but you know, a third of the country should be able to see these on a clear night. Observation tips are look to the west about an hour after sunset when the sun has dipped about 6 to 16 degrees below the horizon. The sun reflects off of those, and it can be quite interesting to look at. These are very high altitude, 50 to 60,000 feet, well above ordinary weather or plane travel. Now, there's a lot in the news, and some of this is so unsettling, I guess would be a good word to put. I don't want to get into the unsettling part, but I would like to get into the very fundamentals of it. You know, we have the IRS being used as a sledgehammer against political enemies of whatever of the administration. This is not new. I mean, those of you that know history know that you know, even Al Capone was brought down by the IRS. Now, that was no random audit. We all know that. He was an enemy of the state, and the state went after him with the weapons that they had at hand. And the IRS certainly had the power to be able to use Mr. Capone's income against him. But we have seen mostly, I'm going to say, liberal Democrat presidents use the IRS as a political tool to weaken or to subvert not the enemies of the state, but the enemies of the party. And that's generally what we're seeing now. We're seeing, you know, organizations that would involve themselves in political activity, whether it's lobbying or awareness or whatever. And obviously they need to raise money to be able to do that activity. And part of the way of raising money is to access various foundations that exist around the planet. And if you know anything about foundations, you know that part of their charter, since they are nonprofit organizations, generally speaking, is to grant money to various organizations, but none of those organizations are for-profit organizations. They're universities, they're hospitals, and other nonprofits. And so if you're going to set up a nonprofit to participate in lobbying efforts or in influencing lawmakers by providing them information, maybe not as a lobby, but as an activist of some kind, an action committee of some kind, then you want to operate as a nonprofit so that you can raise money cleanly without having to be beholden to corporations or private investors or, you know, anything like that. It just makes a cleaner, more detached, more traceable kind of line of money so these things can be understood. I mean, I'm a statistician, and it's often amusing when I teach statistics in college, we talk about clean statistics or legitimate statistics when you turn over the back of your Crest package and it says 4 out of 5 dentists recommend. That's a statistic. But, you know, who were the 4 out of 5 and who was the one dentist that dissented in this statistic? And, you know, you'll have the American Beef Council say how bad bread is for you, so you should eat meat. And you have the American Bread Council saying meat's bad for you and you should live off whole grains. So you have clean statistics and then you have, you know, manipulated numbers saying whatever you wanted to say. So when you have a nice clean line of money, it makes things more understandable, makes things more believable, at least from one side or the other. Systematically denying status to conservative organizations so that they cannot get funded and they cannot operate is a tactic which has never really been tried on this broad of a scale. When you're looking at a party that is literally fighting for its life, I mean, we're on the verge, historically speaking, of the Liberal Democrat Party becoming extinct. It has been in power since World War I of government all but 8 years. Only 8 years in our entire republic after, I would say, you know, the War of 1812, we have had liberal Democrat leadership of the House, the Senate, and the White House. Only 8 years during all that time have we had a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and a Republican in the White House. And that's just the way it is. That's just the way to look at it. So when you look at the systematic dismantling of the republic, taking away the people's representation in the government, and giving life to government itself, it has been largely a liberal Democrat process. the 8 years that it was, you know, sort of dismantled, the nation grew at a faster rate than at any time in history, even after World War II. So when we see this system of government begin to, I'm not going to say be subverted, but when it begins to gain a life of its own, that is to say, it becomes an entity instead of a service to the people. You know, we talk about government service or public service. That's the kind of attitude we want to have about government, any kind of government, whether it's, you know, democratic form of government, a republic, a constitutional monarchy, or whatever. We want to see it serve the people. We want to see it, you know, provide basic utilities like clean water and trash pickup and highway management and interstate commerce control and, you know, things like that. But when government stops governing and starts ruling, then it gets on the other side of the people. And in 1932, when the agency government was originally founded by FDR, we talked about this in depth last week, when there were so many Soviet agents working in Washington, D.C., that Diana West says it was a de facto occupation. Then you see that the foundation of the structure that became what our government is today was laid. We see how that was done. Now, it doesn't really matter who's in the White House, and it doesn't matter now. When we listen to the campaign speeches of the current president back in, you know, 2007, 2005, 2006, 2009 even, we hear a completely different executive branch than what we see operating. So this means one of two things. It either means that we really have, you know, a schizoid in the White House that comes to the microphone and says one thing, and as soon as he steps down from the mic, you know, does something else. Or we have two governments. We have one that steps to the mic and tries to tell the people this is what the Constitution means and this is how we're going to apply it. And then you have the government that chooses or functions in a completely independent manner, not being governed any longer, but doing the ruling itself. Now, two or three things happen, and it's kind of interesting when we look at this as a mystery of how the sociology of a planet works, whether we're talking about a dictatorship or we're talking about a fascist government where the government owns all business, controls all the press, controls all the utilities, and thus controls the people using those things, or whether we're talking about an open republic where you have a representative government where you elect somebody from your neighborhood or your state to go to Washington and represent your state, whether it's Ohio or Arizona or whether it's your county or your neighborhood. We believe as a people that we have that sort of government. In fact, I think we believe as a people that this is really a good form of government, that it would work for almost anybody, that inalienable rights, that basic human dignity, the right to earn a living, the right to speak, the right to own property, the right to marry, you know, the right to inherit, the right to invest and receive benefits from those investments, that those are basic rights that everyone should have. We believe that as a people. But it doesn't necessarily mean that that's exactly what's happening. I mean, perhaps it could happen if you were off the radar enough to where your name or your company name or your product or the function of your company or your business or your livelihood doesn't show up on the radar, doesn't offend anybody, doesn't embarrass anybody, or that you are in line with, you know, whatever it is the agency government, that's what I call it, would like you to do. If you're not in line with that, then you're going to find a very tough way to go. And these days, it seems to be tougher than ever. The agency government has become its own government, and whether it's the EPA, the DOT, the the FDA, the you know, Department of Education or the Department of Environmental Quality in your state, whatever, it has a way of making it rough on any organization or individual that wants to live outside of that or against that. And that's not really what our Constitution is about. Our Constitution specifically protects dissent, and it specifically protects dissent against the government. It specifically protects various means of arming yourself, whether it's with a gun or with your voice or with your money, against government, what can be even, you know, interpreted to be tyranny by the people in that government. That makes a lot of sense, and it seems to be the longest, most enduring constitution that's ever existed on the earth. Yes, we have had societies that have existed longer than the United States. Of course, we've had the Egyptians, we've had Romans, but you see the method of that control. It is either a religious domination of the people through a sort of God-king, or it is through the state having ultimate power and all the taxes rolling into the state, and just through sheer oppression and militaristic threat of complete annihilation that you maintain peace. And for some people, peace is worth that. And for others, I think the majority of humans, peace is not worth that. That giving up all liberty, all freedoms in exchange for security is not acceptable. And so it is in that light that this hour I would like to cover the most recent, I'm going to call it whistleblower activity. I'm going to bring it to you straight. I may throw in some of my opinion, but I want you to form your own about this, because you're going to hear every manner of derogatory judgment that is going to come out of the propaganda machine. You know, here on this program, we have nominated Julian Assange for the Nobel Peace Prize. I doubt he will collect, because there are organizations, not the least of which is the United States, that doesn't like their dirty laundry aired or hung out on the line for people to see. But you have to remember that Julian Assange and the folks at Anonymous never committed any of these crimes. They didn't kill anybody. They didn't ship arms to anyone. They didn't use blackmail and subterfuge and espionage against anyone. What they did do is intercept or find or received vetted documents and transmissions that showed that the United States and representatives of the United States did do these things, that they did commit these crimes, sometimes hundreds of people murdered. Now, because these documents have been released, it's been rather embarrassing, to say the least. But that, my friends, my fellow Earth explorers, is true reporting. Reporting is not, let's go to government and ask them what they want the people to hear, and then let's put it on the teleprompter so that our supermodels can read it, and then people will believe it's news because it comes out on CNN, ABC, NBC, and Fox all at the same time with different actors saying exactly the same words with exactly the same buzzwords, then the people will believe it. That's not reporting. That's propaganda. There's a big difference. Reporting is when you actually see something and you say something, not to government, but to the people. In other words, I saw and recorded with my smartphone a policeman beating up a person on a routine traffic stop because the person called him a name or because he was a different color, or because he was angry about being pulled over. That policeman was not professional. And beating that person with a baton or punching them with a fist or tackling them to the ground and grinding their face into the curb using their knee on the back of their head, that kind of stuff we put a stop to because we report it. And when government does the same thing, figuratively or literally, to the people, we report that too. Now, you can call that leaking. You can call that whistleblowing. But government is made up of people, individuals, people that go home every day, have a mortgage, have kids, have wives, go to church, believe in stuff. They believe in the Constitution. They believe in God, or they believe in decent treatment of other people, other human beings. Government is not made of robots. Government is not made of individuals who think that everybody else on the planet will get sick but them, you see. And every once in a while, one of these people says, I've had enough. I've seen enough. I'm going to grab this file and I'm going down to this news organization and I'm going to give it to them because the people deserve to know what is going on. Whether we're talking about the Pelican Brief or we're talking about the China Syndrome, if you want to go way back, or if we're talking about, you know, any of the things that you see on the movies, how banks treat people or insurance companies treat people or how the NSA, CIA, FBI, you name your alphabet soup, is treating people. And that is what I want to talk about right now. The individual responsible for one of the most significant leaks in U.S. political history. This is a current event. His name is Edward Snowden, a 29-year-old former technical assistant for the CIA and current employee of the defense contractor Booz Allen Hamilton. Snowden has been working at the National Security Agency, that's the NSA, for those of you that are really familiar with just about every conspiracy theory movie out there, there's a real organization called the National Security Agency. What they're trying to secure is who knows. Anyway, he's been there for the last 4 years as an employee of various outside contractors, including Booz Allen and Dell. Now, keep in mind, he's 29 years old. But he has been there for a number of years, which means he has a position of authority, and he's skilled at what he does. The Guardian, after several days of interviews, is revealing his identity at his request. They could keep it secret, but he doesn't want to because he thinks it's important. From the moment he decided to disclose numerous top secret documents to the public, he was determined not to opt for the protection of anonymity. He says, I have no intention of hiding who I am because I know I have done nothing wrong, he said. Same as Julian Assange. Julian Assange releases 20,000 documents to the world. You can read them or not read them. It's up to you. He just is making them available to you. Of this government murdering this number of people or that government buying weapons for that or sending money to this despot. Why? Well, you can put your own conclusions together. Maybe they're manipulating governments or whatever. But this man has no intention of hiding. Now, Snowden will go down in history as one of America's most consequential whistleblowers. Now, you've seen some of late. You've seen Congress interviewing whistleblowers. Now, these aren't people that are ideologically different than the administration in power. They're liberal Democrats too. They've worked for numerous presidents. They're bureaucrats. They survive president after president after president. They're not swept in and out like a giant propaganda machine. These are people that know their job and do their job, and they're very good at their jobs. But when they see something wrong, just wrong, they see people left to die, or they see documents that are destroyed, or they see some kind of thing that's so horrendous against the freedoms and liberties of the American people that they are compelled to say something. They cannot go to their grave with this on their conscience. Then they come forward and they meet with Congress and they tell them. And Congress, if it has any integrity at all, will hold a hearing and will air this material, at least to the lawmakers and hopefully to the American people. This guy is going to go down alongside Daniel Ellsberg and Bradley Manning, who you might know who he is. The Manning trials are going on right now. He is responsible for handing over material from one of the world's most secretive organizations, the National Security Agency, the NSA, the most secretive secret. We didn't even know they existed until probably Hollywood revealed it to us. In a note accompanying the first set of documents he provided, he wrote, "I understand that I will be made to suffer for my actions, but I will be satisfied if the Federation of secret law, unequal pardon, and irresistible executive powers that rule the world that I love are revealed even for an instant." Well, revealed they have been. We heard about the dumping of Verizon, AT&T, and other phone records into a giant database. Why is that? Well, basically because the cell phone companies only keep your records for 3 years and then they toss them. There's no need for it. You're going to change plans by then. You're going to change jobs by then. You know, why keep those records? It's ridiculous. There's no reason to. Well, the government decided that it was important to keep those records, because what if you commit a crime someday? What if you make a statement that's just a little bit over the line someday? Then they can go back year after year after year, and they can get every conversation you have had with your friends, everything you've texted or said on your phone, and they can build you a case. They can take all of those words and use them against you. Free speech? I don't think so. Despite his determination to be publicly unveiled, he repeatedly insisted that he wants to avoid the media spotlight. "I don't want public attention because I don't want the story to be about me. I want it to be about what the U.S. government is doing." He does not fear the consequences of going public, he said. "Only that doing so will distract attention from the issues raised by his disclosures. I know the media likes to personalize political debates," he says, "and I know the government will demonize me." Despite these fears, he remained hopeful. His outing will not divert attention from the substance of his disclosures. Quote, "I really want the focus to be on these documents and the debate which I hope this will trigger among citizens around the globe about what kind of world we want to live in." He adds, "My sole motive is to inform the public as to that which is done in their name and that which is done against them." He has a very comfortable life that included a salary of roughly $200,000, a girlfriend with whom he shared a home in Hawaii, a stable career, and a family he loves. "I'm willing to sacrifice all of that because I can't, in good conscience, allow the U.S. government to destroy privacy, internet freedom, and basic liberties for people around the world with this massive surveillance machine they are secretly building. I'm not afraid because this is the choice I've made." 3 weeks ago, Snowden made final preparations that resulted in last week's series of blockbuster news stories. At the NSA office in Hawaii, where he was working, he copied the last set of documents he intended to disclose. He then advised his NSA supervisor that he needed to be away from work for a couple of weeks in order to receive treatment for epilepsy, a condition he learned he suffers from after a series of seizures last year. As he packed his bags, he told his girlfriend that he had to be away for a few weeks, though he said he was vague about the reason. That is not an uncommon occurrence for someone who has spent the last decade working in the intelligence world. On May 20th, he boarded a flight to Hong Kong, where he has remained ever since. He chose this city because they have a spirited commitment to free speech and the right of political dissent, and because he believed that it was one of the few places in the world that both could and would resist the dictates of the U.S. government. Just talk to Julian Assange, who's been living in a hotel in London for a long time, so that he doesn't face extradition to Norway for trumped-up charges that he battered two women by not wearing a condom during consensual sex. Why? Well, because Norway has open extradition agreements with the U.S. And once Julian makes it to the U.S., you will never hear from him again. In the 3 weeks since Edward arrived, he has been ensconced in a hotel room. "I've left the room maybe a total of three times during my entire stay," he said. "It's a plush hotel, and what with eating meals in his room, too, he has run up big bills. He is deeply worried about being spied on. He lines the door of his hotel room with pillows to prevent eavesdropping. He puts a large red hood over his head and laptop when entering his passwords to prevent any hidden cameras from detecting them." Though that may sound like paranoia to some, Snowden has good reason for such fears. He worked in the U.S. intelligence world for almost a decade. He knows that the biggest and most secretive surveillance organization in America, the NSA, along with the most powerful government on the planet, is looking for him. Since the disclosures began to emerge, he has watched television and monitored the internet, hearing all the threats and vows of prosecution emanating from Washington. And he knows only too well the sophisticated technology available to them and how easy it will be for them to find him. The NSA police and other law enforcement officers have twice visited his home in Hawaii and already contacted his girlfriend, although he believes that may have been prompted by his absence from work and not because of suspicions of any connection to any leaks. "All my opinions are bad," he said. "The U.S. could begin extradition proceedings against him, a potentially problematic, lengthy, and unpredictable course for Washington, or the Chinese government might whisk him away for questioning, viewing him as a useful source of information. Or he might end up being grabbed and bundled into a plane bound for U.S. territory or Guantanamo. Yes, I could be rendered by the CIA. I could have people come after me or any of the third-party partners. They work closely with a number of other nations. Or they could pay off the triads, any of their agents or assets," he said. "We have got a CIA station just up the road, the consulate here in Hong Kong, and I am sure they are going to be busy for the next week, and that is a concern I will live with for the rest of my life, however long that happens to be." Having watched the Obama administration prosecute whistleblowers at a historically unprecedented rate, he fully expects the U.S. government to attempt to use all of its weight to punish him. "I'm not afraid," he said calmly, "because this is the choice I've made." He predicts the government will launch an investigation and say, "I have broken the Espionage Act and helped our enemies," but that can be used against anyone who points out how massive and invasive the system has become. The only time he became emotional during the many hours of interviews was when he pondered the impact his choices would have on his family, many of whom work for the U.S. government. "The only thing I fear is the harmful effects on my family, who I won't be able to help anymore. That's what keeps me up at night," he said, his eyes welling up with tears. He says, "You can't wait around for someone else to act. Snowden did not always believe the government posed a threat to his political values. He was brought up originally in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. His family moved later to Maryland near the NSA headquarters in Fort Meade. By his own admission, he was not a stellar student. In order to get the credits necessary to obtain a high school diploma, he attended a community college in Maryland, studying computing, but never completed the coursework. He later obtained his GED. In 2003, he enlisted in the U.S. Army and began a training program to join the Special Forces. Invoking the same principles that he now cites to justify his leaks, he said, "I wanted to fight in the Iraq War because I felt like I had an obligation as a human being to help free people from oppression." He recounted how his beliefs about the war's purpose were quickly dispelled. "Most of the people training us seemed pumped up about killing Arabs, not helping anyone," he said. After he broke both his legs in a training accident, he was discharged. After that, he got his first job in an NSA facility, working as a security guard for one of the agency's covert facilities at the University of Maryland. From there, he went to the CIA, where he worked on IT security. His understanding of the internet and his talent for computer programming enabled him to rise fairly quickly for someone who lacked even a high school diploma. By 2007, the CIA stationed him with diplomatic cover in Geneva, Switzerland. His responsibility for maintaining computer network security meant he had clearance to access a wide array of classified documents. That access, along with the almost 3 years he spent around CIA officers, led him to begin seriously questioning the rightness of what he saw. He described as formative an incident in which he claimed CIA operatives were attempting to recruit a Swiss banker to obtain secret banking information. Snowden said they achieved this by purposefully getting the banker drunk and encouraging him to drive home in his car. Now, when the banker was arrested for drunk driving, the undercover agent seeking to befriend him offered to help, and a bond was formed that led to successful recruitment. "Much of what I saw in Geneva really disillusioned me about how my government functions and what its impact is in the world," he says. "I realized that I was part of something that was doing far more harm than good." He said it was during his CIA stint in Geneva that he thought for the first time about exposing government secrets. But at the time, he chose not to, for two reasons. First, he said, "Most of the secrets the CIA has are about people, not machines and systems. So I didn't feel comfortable with disclosures that I thought would endanger anyone." Secondly, the election of Barack Obama in 2008 gave him hope that there would be real reforms, rendering disclosures unnecessary. You'll remember that Obama made speeches about unwarranted phishing expeditions through people's phone records and emails, and how he would do everything in his power to stop those from taking place. Well, Edward left the CIA in 2009 in order to take his first job working for a private contractor that assigned him to a functioning NSA facility stationed on a military base in Japan. It was then, he said, that he watched as Obama advanced the very policies that he thought would be reined in. And as a result, he says, "I got hardened." The primary reason from this experience, I'm sorry, the primary lesson from this experience was that you can't wait around for someone else to act. "I'd been looking for leaders, but I realized that leadership is about being the first to act." Over the next 3 years, he learned just how all-consuming the NSA's surveillance activities were, claiming they are intent on making every conversation and every form of behavior in the world known to them. He described how he once viewed the internet as the most important invention in all of human history. As an adolescent, he spent days at a time speaking to people with all sorts of views that I would never have encountered on my own. But he believed that the value of the internet, along with basic privacy, is being rapidly destroyed by ubiquitous surveillance. I don't see myself as a hero, he said, because what I'm doing is self-interested. I don't want to live in a world where there's no privacy and therefore no room for intellectual exploration and creativity. Once he reached the conclusion that the NSA surveillance net would soon be irrevocable, he said it was just a matter of time before he chose to act. What they're doing poses an existential threat to democracy, he said. Now, let me just throw in my own thoughts here. An existential threat to democracy is exactly, precisely, comprehensively what the Constitution is all about. The Founding Fathers knew exactly where ultimate power would lead, either with one man or with one function inside the government. They put language in the Constitution and in the Declaration of Independence, not only carefully describing rights that every human has, whether they're American or not, but protections of those rights, using words like the government shall not infringe upon this right or that. When the founders used language like shall not, Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, Hancock, all the others meant it. It is the foundation upon which this nation was founded. It is the form of government that we not only chose, but for which many, many thousands, hundreds of thousands have died for. It is why we salute the flag. It is why we sing the national anthem. It is why when we travel abroad, we feel so good when we land back in our own country, because these principles are holy to this nation. And when I read a statement that says what they're doing poses an existential threat to that democracy, that tells me that the NSA is an enemy to the state. The NSA and the CIA are enemies of the United States of America. Now let me continue. A matter of principle, as strong as those beliefs are, there still remains the question, why did he do it? Giving up his own freedom and a privileged lifestyle. There are more important things than money. He says, if I were motivated by money, I could have sold these documents to any number of countries and gotten very rich. For him, it is a matter of principle. The government has granted itself power it is not entitled to. There is no public oversight. The result is people like myself have the latitude to go further than they are allowed to, he said. His allegiance to internet freedom is reflected in the stickers on his laptop. I support online rights. Electronic Frontier Foundation, reads one. Another hails the online organization offering anonymity, the Tor Project. Asked by reporters to establish his authenticity to ensure he is not some fantasist, he laid bare without hesitation his personal details, from a social security number to his CIA ID and his expired diplomatic passport. There is no shiftiness. Ask him about anything in his personal life and he will answer. He is quiet, smart, easygoing, and self-effacing. A master on computers, he seems happiest when talking about the technical side of surveillance, at a level of detail comprehensible probably only to fellow communication specialists. but he showed intense passion when talking about the value of privacy and how he felt it was being steadily eroded by the behavior of the intelligence services. His manner was calm and relaxed, but he has been understandably twitchy since he went into hiding, waiting for the knock at the hotel door. A fire alarm goes off. That has not happened before, he said, betraying anxiety, wondering if it was real, a test of a CIA ploy to get him out onto the street. Rush Limbaugh called this action this week a coup d'etat. That is a bloodless takeover of the entire country by this government. Strewn about the side of his bed are his suitcase, a plate with the remains of room service breakfast, and a copy of Angler, the biography of former Vice President Dick Cheney. Ever since last week's news stories began to appear in The Guardian, Snowden has vigilantly watched TV and read the internet to see the effects of his choices. He seems satisfied that the debate he longed to provoke was finally taking place. He lay propped up against pillows, watching CNN's Wolf Blitzer ask a discussion panel about the government intrusion, if they had any idea who the leaker was. From 8,000 miles away, the leaker looked on impassively, not even indulging in a wry smile. Snowden said that he admires both Ellsberg and Manning, but argues that there is one important distinction between himself and the Army private, whose trial coincidentally began this week. Snowden's leaks began to make news. I carefully evaluated every single document I disclosed to ensure that each was legitimately in the public interest, he said. There are all sorts of documents that would have made a big impact that I didn't turn over, because harming people isn't my goal. Transparency is. That's a word we've heard recently, haven't we? Transparency. It means being able to see through to the core. Not like trying to look through a 2x4 or look through a window that's been blacked out to keep things secret on the other side. He purposefully chose, he said, to give the documents to journalists whose judgment he trusted about what should be public and what should remain concealed. As for his future, he is vague. He hoped the publicity the leaks have generated will offer him some protection, making it harder for them to get dirty. He views his best hope as the possibility of asylum with Iceland, with its reputation of a champion of internet freedom at the top of his list. He knows that may prove a wish unfulfilled, but after the intense political controversy he has already created with just the first week's haul of stories, I feel satisfied that this was all worth it. I have no regrets. Now, I'm going to play an interview for you that he did. This is his voice. I want you to listen to his voice, listen to his eloquence, listen to the tone of his voice, listen to the questions and how he answers them. And I want you to make up your own mind. I've read you and given you some of my thoughts. Now, let's listen to him. This is Edward Snowden. He is the NSA.
My name is Ed Snowden. I'm 29 years old. I work for Booz Allen Hamilton as an infrastructure analyst for NSA in Hawaii.
What are some of the positions that you held previously within the intelligence community?
I've been a systems engineer, systems administrator, senior advisor for the Central Intelligence Agency, solutions consultant, and a telecommunications information systems officer.
One of the things people are going to be most interested in trying to understand who you are and what you're thinking is there came some point in time when you crossed this line of thinking about being a whistleblower to making the choice to actually become a whistleblower. walk people through that decision-making process.
When you're in positions of privileged access, like a systems administrator for these sort of intelligence community agencies, you're exposed to a lot more information on a broader scale than the average employee. And because of that, you see things that may be disturbing. But over the course of a normal person's career, you'd only see one or two of these instances. When you see everything, you see them on a more frequent basis. And you recognize that some of these things are actually abuses. And when you talk to people about them in a place like this, where this is the normal state of business, people tend not to take them very seriously and, you know, move on from them. But over time, that awareness of wrongdoing sort of builds up, and you feel compelled to talk about it. And the more you talk about it, the more you're ignored, the more you're told it's not a problem. Until eventually you realize that these things need to be determined by the public, not by somebody who was simply hired by the government.
Talk a little bit about how the American surveillance state actually functions. Does it target the actions of Americans?
NSA and the intelligence community in general is focused on getting intelligence wherever it can, by any means possible, that it believes on the grounds of sort of a self-certification that they serve the national interest. Originally, we saw that focus very narrowly tailored as foreign intelligence gathered overseas. Now, increasingly, we see that it's happening domestically. And to do that, the NSA specifically targets the communications of everyone. It ingests them by default. It collects them in its system, and it filters them, and it analyzes them, and it measures them, and it stores them for periods of time, simply because that's the easiest, most efficient, and most valuable way to achieve these ends. So while they may be intending to target someone associated with a foreign government or someone that they suspect of terrorism, they're collecting your communications to do so. Any analyst at any time can target anyone, any selector anywhere. Where those communications will be picked up depends on the range of the sensor networks and the authorities that that analyst is empowered with. Not all analysts have the ability to target everything. But I, sitting at my desk, certainly had the authorities to wiretap anyone, from you or your accountant to a federal judge to even the president if I had a personal email.
One of the extraordinary parts about this episode is that usually whistleblowers do what they do anonymously and take steps to remain anonymous for as long as they can, which they hope often is forever. You, on the other hand, have decided to do the opposite, which is to declare yourself openly as the person behind these disclosures. Why did you choose to do that?
I think that the public is owed an explanation of the motivations behind the people who make these disclosures that are outside of the democratic model. When you are subverting the power of government, that's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy. And if you do that in secret consistently, you know, as the government does when it wants to benefit from a secret action that it took, it'll kind of give its officials a mandate to go, hey, you know, tell the press about this thing and that thing, so the public is on our side. But they rarely, if ever, do that when an abuse occurs. That falls to individual citizens, but they're typically maligned. You know, it becomes a thing of these people are against the country, they're against the government, but I'm not. I'm no different from anybody else. I don't have special skills. I'm just another guy who sits there day to day in the office, watches what's happening, and goes, this is something that's not our place to decide. The public needs to decide whether these programs and policies are right or wrong. And I'm willing to go on the record to defend the authenticity of them and say, I didn't change these. I didn't modify the story. This is the truth. This is what's happening. You should decide whether we need to be doing this.
Have you given thought to what it is that the U.S. government's response to your conduct is in terms of what they might say about you, how they might try to depict you, what they might try to do to you?
I could be, you know, rendered by the CIA. I could have people come after me or any of their third-party partners. You know, they work closely with a number of other nations. Or, you know, they could pay off the triads or, you know, any of their agents or assets. We've got a CIA station just up the road in the consulate here in Hong Kong, and I'm sure they're going to be very busy for the next week. And that's a fear I'll live under for the rest of my life, however long that happens to be. You can't come forward against the world's most powerful intelligence agencies and be completely free from risk, because they're such powerful adversaries that no one can meaningfully oppose them. If they want to get you, they'll get you in time. But at the same time, you have to make a determination about what it is that's important to you. And if living unfreely but comfortably is something you're willing to accept, and I think many of us are, it's the human nature, you can get up every day, you can go to work, you can collect your large paycheck for relatively little work against the public interest and go to sleep at night after watching your shows. But if you realize that that's the world that you helped create, and it's going to get worse with the next generation and the next generation who extend the capabilities of this sort of architecture of oppression, you realize that you might be willing to accept any risk, and it doesn't matter what the outcome is, so long as the public gets to make their own decisions about how that's applied.
Why should people care about surveillance?
Because even if you're not doing anything wrong, you're being watched and recorded. And the storage capability of these systems increases every year consistently by orders of magnitude, to where it's getting to the point you don't have to have done anything wrong. You simply have to eventually fall under suspicion from somebody, even by a wrong call. And then they can use the system to go back in time and scrutinize every decision you've ever made, every friend you've ever discussed something with, and attack you on that basis to sort of derive suspicion from an innocent life and paint anyone in the context of a wrongdoer.
We are currently sitting in a room in Hong Kong, which is where we are because you traveled here. Talk a little bit about why it is that you came here, and specifically there are going to be people who will speculate that what you really intend to do is to defect to the country that many see as the number one rival of the United States, which is China, and that what you're really doing is essentially seeking to aid an enemy of the United States with which you intend to seek asylum. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So there's a couple assertions in those arguments that are sort of embedded in the questioning of the choice of Hong Kong. The first is that China is an enemy of the United States. It's not. I mean, there are conflicts between the United States government and the Chinese PRC government, but the peoples inherently, you know, we don't care. We trade with each other freely. You know, we're not at war. We're not in armed conflict, and we're not trying to be. We're the largest trading partners out there for each other. Additionally, Hong Kong has a strong tradition of free speech. People think, oh, China, great firewall. Mainland China does have significant restrictions on free speech, but the people of Hong Kong have a long tradition of protesting in the streets, of making their views known. The internet is not filtered here, no more so than any other Western government. And I believe that the Hong Kong government is actually independent in relation to a lot of other leading Western governments.
If your motive had been to harm the United States and help its enemies, or if your motive had been personal material gain, were there things that you could have done with these documents to advance those goals that you didn't end up doing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, anybody in the positions of access with the technical capabilities that I had could, you know, suck out secrets, pass them on the open market to Russia. You know, they always have an open door, as we do. I had access to, you know, the full rosters of everyone working at the NSA, the entire intelligence community, and undercover assets all around the world, the locations of every station we have, what their missions are, and so forth. If I had just wanted to harm the U.S., you know, that you could shut down the surveillance system in an afternoon. But that's not my intention. And I think for anyone making that argument, they need to think, if they were in my position, and you know, you live a privileged life, you're living in Hawaii in paradise and making a ton of money, what would it take to make you leave everything behind? The greatest fear that I have regarding the outcome for America of these disclosures is that nothing will change. people will see in the media all of these disclosures. They'll know the length that the government is going to grant themselves powers unilaterally to create greater control over American society and global society. But they won't be willing to take the risks necessarily to stand up and fight to change things, to force their representatives to actually take a stand in their interests. And the months ahead, the years ahead, it's only going to get worse until eventually there will be a time where policies will change, because the only thing that restricts the activities of the surveillance state are policy. Even our agreements with other sovereign governments, we consider that to be a stipulation of policy rather than a stipulation of law. And because of that, a new leader will be elected. They'll flip the switch, say that because of the crisis, because of the dangers that we face in the world, you know, some new and unpredicted threat, we need more authority. We need more power. And there will be nothing the people can do at that point to oppose it. And it'll be turnkey tyranny.
There you have it. Turnkey tyranny. Is that a word that you would like to see in your future? As each administration has come to power since Roosevelt, and you learned last week that Roosevelt made a conscious or unconscious decision to leave up to 20,000 American troops in Soviet gulags after World War II. These were not necessarily ground troops. Many of them were aviators. They were crews of aircraft that had to bail out over Russian territory or German territory. These POWs that were locked away in German gulags as the Soviets took over the property, they didn't just free the Americans. They captured them, and they put them into gulags and kept them. Roosevelt knew about this. Of course, he had his Valerie Jarrett, too. His Valerie Jarrett was named Harry Hopkins. He was a Soviet agent that approved everything, and even, as you learned by listening to the archive last week, manipulated the entire Allied forces away from the eastern side of Europe so that Russia could, or the Soviets could, take it over and own half of Europe for almost 50 years. That's a lot of power. That's a lot of power. And it sends a chill down my spine when I see Valerie Jarrett get on television and say, and I quote, "I know the mind of the president, and I know William Holder, and I'm telling you, he is here to stay." Let's take a quick break now. Listen to the Alice Band. We'll play After the Gold Rush, and we'll be back right after this with more X Squared Radio after this.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned-out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of Charlotte, North Carolina. Happy you could join us. Some of you might have opinions about whistleblowers, this one in particular, Edward Snowden, being able to carefully release documents that would let us know the extent to which government is monitoring us. And it's interesting to watch the administration, how they are reacting. No, that's not really happening. We're not listening to all your telephone calls. Certainly we would never do anything like that. Come on, people. We've known since the Patriot Act was put into place that maybe we had a good president, maybe we didn't, maybe his intentions were to keep us free, to keep us from being attacked by terrorists. And then the next president comes along and it gets a little bit more pervasive and it gets a little more invasive. And now we're going after, a broader cross-section of Americans, people that have been here for generations and generations, and our thoughts about dissent, not dissent against the government, but maybe dissent against a party or one party or another, one politician or another. Then it becomes the government's business to listen to all that. If you have opinions on that, the phone number toll-free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, it's 530-413-9537. 530-413-9537. And you can also reach us at BBS Radio 2 on Skype. Lots of ways to make your opinion heard. And if you're one of my small number of accepted Skype contacts, you can also instant message me through Skype. I try not to take too much of that because it can get distracting. We used to have a chat line, and the chat line just became just a flood of all kinds of things that had nothing to do with what we were talking about for the day. In fact, it became an open discussion, a side discussion between so many people that it was slowing down the internet connection. So we did away with the chat line. Call in and become a direct part of the program. I'm totally willing to do that. Write me if you want to at bagnew@x2-radio.com, and I promise I will write you back. I write everyone back. But this is a fundamental thing. It's a mystery of how we got to this point. You know, we go back 80 years to the year 1933, and we see how these agencies, the foundations of which were put in place, and over the years, how they've grown, how they've expanded, how the ability to gather intelligence, as Mr. Snowden said, from any source they possibly can, for reasons that remain unclear. You're going to hear all kinds of claims that they thwarted this terrorist attack or that terrorist attack because they had this information. That may or may not be true. In fact, I'm becoming increasingly distrustful of the news of such things. It would sort of be like, and I know you're going to think this is outlandish right now, but trust me, it absolutely is not. Let's say that your wife's going to have a baby this week, maybe tomorrow, maybe Wednesday. And at the hospital, they say, well, it is now government orders that a chip, an RFID chip, like a cow or a sheep or a goat or a pig, is installed under the skin of the back of the neck of your son or daughter. This is for your own good. This is a unique identity that's particular to him. We'll be able to track him now. If he's ever abducted, we can find him in an instant. And if you believe that is good for you, then maybe you'd be excited about that. But let me tell you something. That technology is now not only available, but it is absolutely acceptable to most people. I know you might disagree with that, but let me tell you something. You drive down the freeway sometime and look up and see that sign. It says Amber Alert. Text something like 44138. So you text 44138 and it sends you the Amber Alert. Look for this car with this license plate number. It's believed to have the abducted son or daughter of so-and-so and in this general area. That's how they find kids. And that's light years ahead of where it used to be. Light years ahead of where it used to be. But you let one child be found using an RFID chip under their skin, in their tennis shoes, in their book bag. Something their kidnapper would never suspect looking for. You let one child be recovered because their parent authorized an RFID chip to be put on their son or daughter. And you'll have 200 million Americans voting that policy in instantaneously. You think iris scanning is invasive as a security measure? Fingerprints, DNA, sound of your voice, any of that? Maybe not. Maybe not. Because most of you feel that, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, if you're not saying anything on the phone that's, you know, could be questioned, and you have nothing to worry about. Think back. Think back 3 years. Have you said anything on the phone? Have you texted anything or received a text or a phone call from anyone? Have you received an email or sent an email or went to a website or read a paper that had anything that might be derogatory to the current administration? Well, that's enough time to think about that. All of that is out there. And now, you know, it will never go away. So if you commit a crime or you get in a fight or you stand up at a PTA meeting or you go to a political rally or you run for office, they can go back to every one of your phone calls, every one of your emails, every one of your texts that you either gave or received and use it against you. Now that's a pretty narrow line, a pretty narrow gate for you to walk, is it not? God will forgive you and you can overcome a bad habit and forget about it as though it never existed, but government will never forget. All right, let's talk about a subject that's kind of near and dear to my heart. Those of you that have kids already do this to some extent because you sit around your supper table each school night and do homework with your kids. And you talk about history and you talk and you discuss mathematics and you discuss English papers and on and on and on. It's a form of what is now known as homeschooling. As dissatisfaction with the U.S. public school system grows, and it does almost everywhere, apparently so has the appeal of homeschooling. Educational researchers, in fact, are expecting a surge in the number of students educated at home by their parents over the next 10 years as more parents reject public schools. Well, first of all, let's just toss in why would why would parents be in a state of mind to reject public schools? If you have a working father and a working mother, do you realize what a sacrifice it would be for the mom or the dad to stay home 5 days a week and teach school several grades worth if you have multiple kids? It's a heck of a sacrifice. But sometimes the education of the student, the child, is more important than, you know, buying a new home or building up a 401k. Well, a recent report in Education News states that since 1999, 14 years ago, the number of children who are homeschooled has increased by 75%. Though homeschooled children represent only 4% of school-aged children nationwide, the number of children whose parents choose to educate them at home rather than a traditional academic setting is growing 7 times faster than the number of children enrolling in grades K through 12 every year. As homeschooling has become increasingly popular, common myths that have long been associated with the practice of homeschooling have been debunked, and they've been debunked multiple times. Okay. Any concerns about the quality of education children receive by their parents can be put to rest by the consistently high placement of homeschooled students on standardized assessment exams. And by the way, these are government standardized tests. The parents have no idea what's on those tests. Neither do the students until they actually sit down to take that test. That's what I'm saying. Teachers in the public school system do know what's on that test. They get reports what's on that test. They teach that test very carefully, very meticulously. Why? Because the school where they are employed is graded on how the students do on that test. So they must do well. Data demonstrates that those who are independently educated generally score between the 65th and 89th percentile on these measures, while those in traditional academic settings average around the 50th percentile. That's not even close. That's way outside the margin of error. It is very clear that homeschooled students learn better. Now, here's the interesting thing. A homeschooled child does not spend as long in class each day as a public school child. A homeschooled child is not being taught by a professional educator with a college degree. A homeschooled child is only learning at the rate of discipline of the parent that's teaching that child. And I can tell you, most parents just, they don't have the patience to do homework, let alone sit there for 4, 5, 6 hours a day teaching. And most students, I can tell you, from grades 1 through 12, do not have the self-discipline to sit there and study on their own. So you have to have that teaching. You have to have. Now, it can be said, well, that's the value of one-on-one attention. Well, maybe so. But when you're talking to someone who hasn't been in high school for 10 or 15 or 20 years, hasn't read a textbook and doesn't even know what one looks like unless they're looking at their student's textbook, I'd say that is a hollow argument. In addition, achievement gaps between sexes, income levels, or ethnicity, all of which have plagued public schools around the country, do not exist in homeschooling environments. In other words, Hispanics, African Americans, they have no problem learning in homeschool environments and doing well on the exams. According to the report, recent studies laud homeschoolers' academic success, noting their significantly higher ACT composite scores as high schoolers and higher grade point averages as college students. Yet, surprisingly, the average expenditure for the education of a homeschooled child per year per year is $500 to $600, compared to an average expenditure of $10,000 per child per year for public school students. Now, keep in mind, an average class size is, what, 23 to 28 students? You have one teacher in there. So you have one teacher in that class, let's say 20 students, $10,000 apiece. That's $200,000 a year that's being spent in that room on those 20 children. Those 20 children could be taught at home for about $10,000. The high achievement level of homeschoolers is readily recognized by recruiters from some of the best colleges in the nation. Home-educated children matriculate in colleges and attain a four-year degree at a much higher rate than their counterparts from both public and private schools. Schools such as Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Harvard, Stanford, Duke universities all actively recruit homeschoolers because they want successful students. It should also be noted here that you remember the Education Edge program or the Goals 2000 program where we talked about core curricula. We discussed this about a month and a half ago. Look it up in the archives and you'll see it. Where you don't receive a high school diploma, you receive a Certificate of Initial Mastery, a CIM, and a Certificate of Advanced Mastery, a CAM. You only receive this through the government schools. You have to choose a core curricula in the sixth grade and then work through it. If you change your core curricula away from, say, general studies to science and technology or hospitality or health services, you have to start over because it is not a broad-based education. It's a results-based education. It's an outcome-based education. In other words, what you're going to school to do is to learn how to get a job. You're being trained as a worker. If you don't believe me, go back and listen to the political campaigns of this last election. Middle class working families, workers, that's what you are. You're being trained to work. You're being trained to hold a job. That's not the function of education, and you know it. The function of education is to teach you how to learn, is to teach you how to think, and how to engage in a lifetime of learning. Because they know that a society that is ever learning is going to continue to advance long after you graduate high school. You listen to Ed Snowden, you listen to his method of speech, you listen to the subject matter that he's talking about, and you can clearly see in his method of language that this is not someone who struggled to get a GED. This is a highly intelligent person that had a problem with the public school system, but he learned how to learn. Similarly, the common myth that homeschoolers miss out on a so-called socialization opportunity offered by public education, often thought to be a vital aspect of traditional academic settings, has also proven to be without merit. According to the National Home Education Research Institute survey, homeschoolers tend to be more socially engaged than their peers and demonstrate healthy social, psychological, and emotional development and success into adulthood. Why do they do that? Because they're not engaged in the day-to-day fashion show. They're not gobbled up by bullies. And I'm not talking about just physical bullies. I'm talking about emotional bullies who beat them down because they have an accent or beat them down because their skin is of a different color because they live in a different part of the neighborhood of the city. Beat them down because their mom drops them off in a minivan instead of a Cadillac Escalade. Going to public schools is brutal sometimes. You witness things that change you. You witness people being brutalized. You witness people being sexually assaulted, not only from other students, but also adults. And it changes you. It robs you of your innocence. You don't see that at homeschool. You're not exposed to those kinds of pressures. Does that make you imbalanced or unable to handle social stress later in life? I doubt it. Psychological strength and social strength and emotional development is as strong as it could be in homeschooled children. Also from the report, based on recent data, researchers such as Dr. Brian Ray expect to observe a notable surge in the number of children being homeschooled in the next 5 to 10 years. The rise would be in terms of both absolute numbers and percentage of the K-12 student population. If you live in a state that has, if you look at, let's say, Massachusetts, that has the number one K-12 education in the country, that's one thing. But let's look at the other 49 states, or 50 states if you want to include Puerto Rico. Let's look at them for a moment. Look at Arkansas. Look at Louisiana. Look at Mississippi. Look at Arizona. Look at the difference between Kentucky and Tennessee. A whopping 20 placement points in K-12 education between Kentucky and Tennessee, or North Carolina and Tennessee. Huge differences in K-12 education. Not because of the money that's being spent, but because of the emphasis on curricula, the emphasis on performance, the emphasis on math and science, the emphasis on the quality of the teacher that's in that classroom, inversely proportional to other things like the strength of the teacher's union in that state. The increase would be in part because, number one, a large number of those individuals who were being home educated in the 1990s may begin to homeschool their own children now that they are parents. And two, the continued successes of home educated students. In other words, success breeds success. If homeschooled students are doing so well, even though you don't have a professional teacher at home with a college degree, then wherein lies the problem? Is it the fact that you don't have as highly an educated teacher in the classroom, or is it the fact that there's something other than educating going on in the school systems? Well, let's find out. I mean, one of the things you can do is just follow the money. I've got a short clip here. Now, this is taking place in another state, but it could be typical of any state. You'll see what happens to the budget when kids' families are smaller and number of kids in schools, because that's how schools are paid, is by the number of heads that are in desks each day. And when those budgets are cut back because the number of attendance is low, or because, as you realize, in most county school systems or counties, the school system is the biggest expenditure, usually takes up between 60 and 70% of the budget. But if you have a county that wants to do other things besides educating students, then they're going to siphon that money off to do other things, and then you get into a budget crunch. We've seen a lot of that lately with cities like Compton and cities around the country struggling to keep themselves above bankruptcy. Let's listen to the clip.
Also breaking, the superintendent of Philadelphia schools says it's the harsh reality of the budget crisis. Layoff notices are going out to more than 3,000 employees. Eyewitness News reporter Todd Quinones joins us live tonight from district headquarters with the breaking details. Todd.
Well, Diana, it is a devastating reality. Every single assistant principal within the school district of Philadelphia will be out of a job as of July 1st, and the cuts don't end there. Music teachers as well as counselors will also be hit hard with job losses. This is all a direct result of the so-called doomsday budget the SRC adopted on May 30th. The district right now is facing a $300 million budget shortfall. Superintendent William Hite has said the budget cuts fall catastrophically short of meeting student needs, but he added the district has to live with the money it has now, not the money district leaders wish they had.
These numbers also paint a devastating picture of a public school system that is severely underfunded and overtaxed by labor costs. I'm doing everything in my power to prevent this budget from becoming a reality on July 1st.
Here's a breakdown of the 3,783 employees being laid off, 127 assistant principals, 676 teachers, 283 counselors, 1,202 aides, 307 secretaries, and 769 supportive service assistants will all lose their jobs. The head of the teachers union has called the cuts unconscionable.
The direction that the district is going in right now is the wrong direction. Wrong for the children of Philadelphia. It's wrong for the ladies and gentlemen who only go to work every day to educate our kids.
Well, the district will also be asking for an additional $60 million from city council, as well as $120 million from the state. The district will also be asking for about $100 million in givebacks from the teachers union. If all of that happens, the plan is to amend the budget that was just recently adopted, and so that at least some of the jobs that were cut could be reinstated.
So it all boils down to jobs. By the way, I don't know if you paid attention to those numbers. I did. 17.9% of those cuts were teachers. The rest of those cuts, and by the way, the teachers have the lowest salaries among anyone there except for the assistants, and we're like 1,200 of those being laid off. Only 17.9% of them were teachers. The rest of them were all administrators or assistants. They didn't do any of the teaching. So therein lies the problem. At a home school, you can spend $600 a year teaching a student and come out with a superior education. My grandmother went to a one-room classroom, a one-room school. All eight grades were taught in the same room by the same teacher. And she was brilliant. She was brilliant. She taught me to read by the time I was four. And I don't mean read C, Dick and Jane Run. I mean I was reading the LA Times at four. So it can be done. You don't have to be a professional educator. I say support your homeschooling network in your area with everything that you've got. Because that is really the future of America right there. That's the future of the world. All right, let's round out this hour with a drone wars update. You know, the Navy is preparing to launch an unmanned aircraft from the deck of an aircraft carrier for the first time. The X-47B is about the size of a traditional fighter plane. It can reach an altitude of more than 40,000 feet and has a range of more than 2,100 nautical miles. It is scheduled to catapult off the flight deck of the USS George H.W. Bush in the Atlantic Ocean. Probably did it this week. The plane isn't intended for operational use, but it will be used to help develop other unmanned carrier-based aircraft. Navy officials say the planes will provide around-the-clock carrier-based intelligence, surveillance, and targeting capabilities. I could see having a small eye in the sky over a battle group at sea would give you over-the-horizon defense capabilities. Following the test launch, the plane will make a series of approaches toward the aircraft carrier before landing at Naval Air Station, Patuxent River in Maryland. So we see a lot of this going on. The Chinese, as you know, launched a drone that almost looks exactly like the RQ-170. That's the one that was taken over and landed by Iranians in Iran. I mean, it looks exactly like it. Like, well, where'd you get that design? They also have another one called the Dark Sword. It's kind of futuristic looking, but it's a supersonic anti-aircraft drone. It's designed to shoot down other aircraft, surveillance aircraft, fighters maybe. Of course, it can outturn, outperform any regular aircraft because there's nobody in it. You don't have to worry about squashing the occupants. It can make a 9G turn, whereas a regular aircraft can't make that for very long because the pilot will black out. It is also a stealth aircraft that can fly very, very fast. Also in the news recently, China has been selling weapons systems to America's neighbors, Venezuela, you know, different countries like that. And the interesting thing is that when the weapons arrive, the tanks or the guns or the systems, they fall apart. The Chinese quality is not what they expected, not what they paid for. Yeah, welcome to the real world. So now those countries are trying to do business with Russia and buy Russian weapons. Of course, they're going to be far more expensive, and probably will work. It's difficult to say, but that's just very typical of Chinese stuff that you buy. You have to be very, very careful about the quality. Now, also recently, we have heard about the IRS being used to target various political, various organizations with various political leanings. In other words, the IRS has become the strong man, the muscle behind this idea that those that would dissent against the current administration, whether it's Republican or Democrat, are enemies of the state and will be treated that way by the IRS. Interestingly enough, though, when we go back and look at the records under Bush, more conservative organizations were delayed and examined thoroughly than liberal organizations. Not to say that Bush was a tremendous conservative, because he wasn't. He had was almost liberal for a Republican. But now, clearly, it doesn't take anyone. I mean, a nine-year-old could see that liberal organizations sail right through getting their 501c3 or 501c4 status almost without any struggle at all. And the conservative ones, you know, have been years getting it and still don't get it. And so they literally starve them out and run them out of money. And it's not the only organization. The EPA has been doing this. The DOT has been doing this. I mean, come on. These organizations are used and abused by the administration to support those who donate money to the cause and to hurt those that do not, or even worse, donate money to the opposition. And that is why there is a call now, has been for a while, since I published Alienated Nation, book that came out last June and made it to number one on Amazon. It beat out several of the popular hosts out there, Rachel Maddow and others. I beat them all to pieces with the book. In the book, we have a section about certain amendments that had to be repealed and certain amendments that had to be passed in order to reclaim the republic. And one of them is the 30th Amendment. Oh, I know. We only have 27 amendments, but the IRS must go. And that's why the 30th Amendment is so necessary. Here's what it says. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on any transaction of commerce wherein currency is the form of trade. The rate shall be uniform for all commerce conducted in the several states without exemption. The tax shall be collected at the point of sale and rendered unto the United States Treasury no more than 30 days from the day of the transaction. Congress shall not have the power to lay and collect taxes from income or profits. That's the 30th Amendment. See, these amendments are usually pretty clean, pretty simple, and use the words like shall not have the power. And that way they're nice and clean, and you don't have a lot of legal falderal and ambiguity. Obviously, that means the 16th Amendment, which allows the federal government to lay and collect taxes from income or profits, has to be repealed. I don't know any American that would not support that. Now, it can be said that a use tax or a value-added tax, which this is more oppressive to some peoples than others, but those arguments are hollow and hold no merit whatsoever. If you think they do, you can give me a call at 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Or if you live outside the United States and you've seen these things happen before in your country, you see how oppressive governments can be when they take 20, 30, 70% of your income and then, you know, provide services to those who need them. And of course, in most countries like Greece or even others, they're not people who need them. They're people who want them. They're people who live off of them and don't produce anything. You've seen the results of that. The number is 530-413-9537 if you want to have a discussion on this. I can tell you from just looking at the way that the 1040, the whole tax return system works, that this is a waiver of the Fifth Amendment. You are incriminating yourself when you fill out that return. You are telling the government how much you make when they already know how much you make based on your W-2s because your employer has reported it to them. All they're really trying to do is find out whether you are telling the truth or not. And if you withhold something, then you're going to be caught. And if you do it intentionally, then you're going to be jailed. But the bottom line is that many Americans believe that the government has no right to know how much you earn. In fact, you should be allowed to earn as much as you possibly can, any way that you can that's legal. You can paint houses, mow grass, cut hair, you can clean pools, you can do any manner of services for cash, you can earn interest, anything that you want. In fact, I would say that about 20 to 30% of the culture of the United States is a subculture that does not exist on the rolls of the IRS. And I'm talking about everything from undocumented occupants or residents of our country. You can call them illegal aliens if you want to, but some of them have been here for generations. They don't pay taxes. They don't file tax returns. They're not documented. They don't have Social Security numbers. They work in fields picking peppers and cucumbers. They haul trash. They do all kinds of stuff that you don't want to do. That's good money to them based on or compared to where they came from. And then eventually they'll become naturalized and their kids are born here. And so one or two generations, they're all washed out anyway. The point is that the current system doesn't work. Because you have tourists, you have drug dealers, you have all kinds of people to work for various levels of cash. None of that gets taxed. None of that's in the system. None of that is even counted into the gross national product. It also takes some 275,000 IRS agents and IRS workers to track all this money, to try to find it all out. Huge, elaborate, high-speed computer systems, checking and rechecking systems. You know how long it takes for your tax return to be processed? Minutes, minutes. Sometimes you receive a notice the very hour or the next day that your return has been received, that it's been processed, and your check will be out in so many days. That's not a human being reading that thing. They're computers that do all that stuff. And you have organizations out there like H&R Block that have made empires managing those tax returns. You have accountants and tax attorneys, all kinds of industries that are based upon trying to give the IRS as little as possible of the money that corporations or individuals are earning. And those corporate taxes have reached such a high level, 35% in the United States, highest in the world, that those corporations have left. They've left the building. They're overseas. They've set up in Ireland or they've set up in Antigua or they've set up in, you know, some other country. Why? So they don't have to pay taxes. Now, you think about that, a company that makes $1 billion, $5 billion, $100 billion a year in business. You think they're going to give up 35% of that to the American government? You're crazy. They're going to go someplace else. And when they do, they're taking their employees with them. Do you realize we're at the same stage, a number of manufacturing jobs that we were in 1968? Hello, this is 2013. That's how far we have slid back. Whole industries we have lost, and we lose significant amounts of industries each year just because of our tax policy. Now, if we were to, say, take the corporate tax to, say, how about zero? Yeah, that's a good number. Zero income tax. And then what you do is you tax everything they buy. Every television, every pair of tennis shoes, every car, every bag of grass seed, everything you buy gets a tax. Let's say 3%. Let's say 3% of everything that's bought in the United States gets taxed. Now you don't have a surge of money come April 15th piling into the government. The government figures out whether it can pay its bills or not. You have money coming in every single day from all over the country. And guess who buys stuff? That's right. Tourists buy stuff. There are millions of them in the United States at any given moment, any given year. And every single time they buy something, they're going to pay the tax. Bingo, you get part of that money. How about the whole cash subculture? People that mow grass, work on cars, paint houses, cut hair, do nails, all kinds of cash businesses. Yep, you get their money too because they buy stuff. And how about all the drug dealers and illegal activities that go on in this country, all the money laundering? Yep. You get that money too because they buy stuff too. And rich people, they buy a whole lot more than poor people do. And they pay more tax. Now, if you get the ultra poor, you get the poor down around $7,000, $10,000, $20,000 a year in income. If you need to, you can give them a tax-free card so that they can still purchase stuff without paying the 3% federal tax. But trust me, they will never even feel it. It's less than the bounce of 10 cents in the price of gasoline. Now, what do you do with 275,000 IRS agents? I'm glad you asked that question. You take the entire agency, the Internal Revenue Service, and you turn it on the agencies of the government. You assign them agency by department, by bureau, by administration to take apart the graft, the waste, the duplication, the fraud, and you let the IRS turn in on the agencies themselves and put them to work auditing government. Put them to work auditing the agencies themselves. That is what you do with the IRS. Believe me, they will have their hands full. And every single time they win, they find something else that's being wasted, something else that's being duplicated, something else that's being defrauded, whether it's health care, whether it's road service, all that stuff would be eliminated. And we wouldn't have articles like the IRS scandal is growing by leaps and bounds in a way that must be terrifying to an administration already dealing with the fallout from the uncovering of their Libya lies and the knowledge that the Department of Justice seized the phone records of 20 Associated Press reporters. You don't have problems like that because the IRS is on the job. They're finding all this stuff inside our government, and they're not asking each and every American every year to waive their Fifth Amendment rights by telling the government how much they earn, by incriminating themselves every single time they file those documents with the United States Internal Revenue Service. Let's set it right. It could be done in one afternoon. All we need is the 50 governors to get together and meet. There are 40 of them, by the way, that have already passed sovereignty agreements, sovereignty statements, where they have basically said, we're not going to enforce any federal laws in our state unless our state legislature has ratified them. Of course, that's what the Civil War was fought about, so I doubt that they'll go that far. These are basically statements of legality more than anything else. But I can tell you that they are important because those 40 states will make the decision that this 30th Amendment will pass. And when it does, it empowers the Supreme Court to rule unconstitutional the way that the current IRS operates. And so it must be dismantled. It must be replaced with a national sales tax. And then, my friends, you can earn as much as you want any way that is legal that you want. And no one will look over your shoulder. Nobody cares how much you make. Oh, yeah, there'll be one more small side effect from this. All those corporations that left the United States of America to take their jobs overseas, they're going to come home. They're going to come home to here. And we'll be back to 2 or 3% unemployment, and we will become the shining city on the hill once again. That's how it's done. One simple amendment. So simple, so easy. Let's see if we can get it done. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back after this with more X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew.
You say you love me, and I hardly know your name. Myself to blame, but there's something inside that's turning my mind away. Oh, I could love you if I could let you stay.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of Charlotte, North Carolina. We're live every Sunday between 5 and 8 Pacific, 8 and 11 Eastern Time. Our phone number is 888-429-5471 if you want to call in anywhere from North America toll-free, 530-413-9537 anywhere else on planet or off planet. In case you happen to be near McDonald Observatory, it is a Texas-based astronomical site that is known not only for work gazing at the stars, but also for educating the public about them. The observatory produces a daily program called Stardate, which runs on nearly 300 radio stations across the country. A research facility of the University of Texas at Austin, McDonald has several telescopes perched on Mount Locke and Mount Foulkes, part of the Davis Mountains range in western Texas. Among them is the Hobby Eberle Telescope, a 30-foot observatory that is one of the world's largest optical telescopes. McDonald came to be due to an unexpected legacy from a banker in Paris, Texas, according to the Texas State Historical Association. William Johnson McDonald died in 1926 at age 81 and arranged for $850,000, the equivalent of $11 million in modern dollars, to be used for starting up an astronomical observatory. McDonald is said to have thought that an observatory would improve weather forecasting and therefore help farmers plan their work. Because the university didn't have any astronomy expertise, it made a work arrangement with the University of Chicago for 3 decades, where the Illinois institution would provide astronomers that would use the new Texas Observatory. The first major telescope, STRUVE, was finished in 1939 with a mirror spanning 82 inches. That telescope is still in use today. The university, however, added other telescopes through the decades. Notable telescopes include Hobby Eberle, dedicated in 1997, and the 107-inch Harlan J. Smith Telescope, then the third largest in the world when completed in 1968. McDonald's most notable scientific effort these days is the Hobby Eberle Telescope Dark Energy Experiment. That's why I thought you would enjoy this article, because we often talk about dark energy and we talk about dark matter and we really don't know much about either one. Billed as the first major experiment searching for the mysterious force pushing the universe's expansion, it could answer the questions such as, if the laws of gravity are correct and reveal new details about the Big Bang in which the universe was born. That's what their project website states. Well, HETDEX will make observations of a minimum of 1 million galaxies to produce a large map showing the universe's expansion rate during different time periods. Any changes in how quickly the universe grows could yield differences in dark energy. Observations are expected to start later in 2013, this year, after the telescope gets a new wide-field corrector, a set of glasses, that should allow it to see a larger part of the sky as well as several spectrographs. In recent years, astronomers using the observatory's telescopes have discovered a huge, massive magnetic star pulling charged particles along with it and tracked likely comets in alien planet systems, among other findings. This is sort of the missing link in current planetary formation studies, stated lead author Barry Welsh of the University of California, Berkeley, concerning the comet discoveries. The discovery brought the number of known stars with exocomets to 10. Now, I do have some GMO news. I covered a little bit of this last week, but this is really, really important, so I want you to know it. You know, Japan is one of the largest buyers of U.S. wheat. And Japan has actually suspended some imports of U.S. wheat. And that just happened, like in the last week. It was discovered that genetically engineered wheat was found on an Oregon farm. Now, we've talked about GMO foods here. We've talked about corn. We've talked about soybeans. We've talked about other various crops, cotton, etc., that had been tested in third world countries. But third world countries don't grow a lot of wheat. Wheat is grown in Russia. Wheat is grown in the United States primarily. Wheat is grown in Australia, the three biggest growers of wheat in the world. So it seems a little strange that GMO wheat would be found in the middle of what we call the wheat belt. Now, I don't know if you know much about wheat. I don't, but I did build a biodiesel plant up in Odessa, Washington, right smack in the middle of wheat country. So I got to spend some time with wheat farmers and former wheat farmers and wheat politicians, and I learned a lot about it. I met Senator Maria Cantwell. I met representatives of Christine Gregoire, then the governor of Washington State. And I can tell you that wheat is the breadbasket. It is the source of life, the staff of life for not only our country, but other countries as well. And the highest quality wheat of the world is grown right there because of the strangely volcanic soil of the Pacific Northwest. Now, the Agriculture Department announced the discovery of this GMO wheat on Wednesday. No genetically engineered wheat has been approved for American farming. You should know that. I told you already when we did our GMO updates earlier in the year, wheat is the one product that has been, shall we say, protected from infection by genetically modified wheat. You're not allowed to grow it in this country because this is the food supply. This is where all the bread, all the noodles, all the cereal, everything comes from this wheat belt. Now, Japan is one of the largest export markets for American wheat growers. Katsuhiro Saka, a counselor at the Japanese embassy in Washington, said Thursday that Japan had canceled orders of Western white wheat from the Pacific Northwest and also some of the feed-grade wheat. In most countries, the unapproved genetically modified wheat would be a target of concern, Mr. Saka said. The Japanese people have similar kinds of concerns. They don't want to eat genetically modified foods. In addition, the European Union said it would test incoming American shipments and block any containing genetically modified wheat. The mystery could have implications on wheat trade. Many countries around the world will not accept imports of genetically modified foods, and the United States exports about half of its wheat crop. Many people are asking why they are banning U.S. wheat in this protest. The answer could be found in two words. Are you ready? You're going to get used to these words because you're going to hear them often on this program and others. Two words: genetic pollution. This proves, without any question, that Monsanto's genetic experiments, which escaped into commercial wheat fields, are now going to devastate U.S. wheat farmers. Expect the floor to drop out on wheat prices, and watch for a huge backlash against the USDA by U.S. farmers who stand to lose hundreds of millions of dollars on this. Now, in this article that I've put together, I'm going to try to connect the dots for you between the USDA and Monsanto and what's being done to the world's food supply. You might want to cinch up that seatbelt just a little bit. Go ahead and put the tray table up too. This could be rough. As the USDA has now admitted, Monsanto's GMO experiments from 1998 to 2005 were held in open wheat fields. I don't know if you know how incredibly dangerous that actually is. Now, we're talking about 1998 to 2005. This is an experiment that ended 8 years ago, 8 years ago, eight seasons ago. It lasted for 7 years. Now, while I was in Odessa, I got to work with the Public Development Authority. Great, great bunch of people, very concerned about their community, very active in their community, absolute stalwarts, all of them, great examples of Americans, and it was a pleasure to work with them for a year. We all worked very hard to complete that biodiesel plant, and it is completed and running, and it does a great job. Now, while I was attending one of the meetings at the Public Development Authority, there was a group that was experimenting with a special kind of safflower plant that had been genetically modified to make insulin or make something that would be a good substitute for insulin. There was a space in the industrial park where these flowers, the seeds from these flowers or whatever part of the flower they were rendering into this chemical could be processed. One of the things that was overriding everything, the main theme of what governed what they were trying to do, is that it was very important that those safflower plants that they were growing be kept a minimum distance, and I'm thinking it was something like 2 miles minimum, where no safflower plant could grow within pollination distance of their safflowers. No bee, no bird, no insect, and especially no airborne pollen could blow. And believe me, the wind blows all the time up there. No pollen particle could be transported from these safflower plants to natural safflower plants and thus infect the field or pollute the field genetically. And I think it was determined that they would or they would not process the safflowers in that industrial park because it was a little too close. I think that's what it came down to, if I remember right. Neither here nor there. The most important thing was that the safflowers were going to be grown in an open field, but they weren't going to be grown in open safflower fields. That's why when the USDA now admits some 8 years later that Monsanto conducted genetically modified organism experiments for 7 years in open wheat fields next to wheat fields that were full of natural white wheat is the most irresponsible, devastating, risky activity that I've ever heard of. Another government agency acting up. The genetically engineered wheat escaped as expected and found its way into commercial wheat fields in Oregon and possibly 15 other states, causing self-replicating genetic pollution that now taints the entire U.S. wheat industry. You see, once the wheat's in, it also gets into the next year's seed crop. Those genetic markers are already in there. That means that the wheat that's going to be planted next year is also going to be altered. Asian consumers are keenly sensitive to gene-altered food, with few countries allowing imports of such cereals for human consumption, writes Reuters. It continues. Asia imports more than 40 million tons of wheat annually, almost a third of the global trade of 140 to 150 million tons. The bulk of the region's supplies come from the United States, the world's biggest exporter, and Australia, the number two supplier. Another incredible Monsanto achievement, the genetic contamination of the U.S. wheat supply, with the USDA working right alongside of them. Nice job, Monsanto. You've managed to spew your genetic pollution across the fields of innocent U.S. farmers who are now going to lose huge sums of money due to the rejection of U.S. wheat by all other world nations that refuse to feed their populations GMO. And a big thumbs up to the USDA as well for screwing U.S. farmers by greenlighting open field GMO experiments that we all warned were going to result in runaway genetic pollution. They already knew this. We told them about it. The USDA, of course, is the official cheerleading squad for Monsanto's criminal science that we all know is a total fraud. How do these scientists now suggest these self-replicating genetic pollution be put back into the black box from which it emerged? Many say it can't be done, of course. So now the entire future of the U.S. wheat supply is at risk thanks to Monsanto and the USDA. Score another victory for the destroyers in Washington, D.C., and the greed-driven executives at our favorite corporation. And remember, genetically modified wheat is only the beginning. Monsanto has no doubt unleashed genetic pollution across many other crops as well. We are living in an age where Monsanto is essentially seeding its patented seed across the farms of America deliberately, and then claiming to own the contaminated crops. What a wonderful image of corporate responsibility and service to humankind. I can't wait to see what other U.S. crops will be rejected by world nations due to Monsanto's genetic pollution. Now, there is a question that remains. Why would the USDA allow Monsanto to grow genetically aggressive experimental wheat in open fields near the world's largest wheat basket? Why would you do that? I already told you, isolation is key when you're doing this kind of stuff. As I told you about the safflower plants that were genetically modified to produce a component of artificial insulin. You see, the USDA had a requirement that the genetically altered safflower crop had to grow to maturity a long ways away from any ordinary or, shall we say, clean safflower crop to avoid cross-pollination. It was their requirement. Of course, this was a small company that was trying to develop a new drug. Now, the USDA knew full well that cross-pollination would occur with the Monsanto brand. They knew that once the wheat was contaminated with Monsanto's genetic pollution, that there would be two generations of wheat lost. Two generations, not just one, because the fields would have to be burned. And then the seeds that come up naturally the next year would have to be burned again before they were allowed to seed. You would have to kill the plants to the root. Only then could the genetically modified the normal seeds be replanted. Only then. I call them BM, before Monsanto. By then, half the world will starve without the wheat, the millions of tons of wheat that come from the Pacific Northwest alone being grown. In the third season, the CRP land could be activated and a bumper crop could make up storage that will be lost. But you're talking three growing seasons. The current one must be torched to the ground. It must be burned. And then, without plowing or anything, let the seeds that are already in the ground, that are just laying there, that don't get caught by the fire, whatever, let them come up naturally the next year and burn those too before they go to seed. Burn them while they're just golden grass. Burn them all. Millions of acres of wheat burnt to the ground. Then the third season you could plant before Monsanto seed. There is no choice now. if we are to avoid this massive pollution. It is the worst attack on the global food supply that has ever been perpetrated by any force ever. It makes a plague of locusts look like nothing because it destroys every wheat crop in the future unless the decision is made to completely and utterly destroy these seeds off the earth. It is more devastating than the Romans salting the fields of their enemies to prevent them from growing food to feed their armies to come back and fight them. By the way, all of that soil blew away and is now part of the desert sand. It never, ever grew crops again. And, of course, that, as you well know, will never happen. Monsanto, no doubt, has not only paid hundreds of millions of dollars to make sure this would happen, but they also made sure their hand-picked employees were hired by the USDA to ensure this occurred as planned. They even bought and paid for the members of Congress that not only approved the agency's actions, but passed legislation to make sure they could not be sued when they seized the world's wheat crop through genetic infiltration. Them are good-looking genes, the shareholders of Monsanto say. It has been a long, expensive, and careful plan to genetically take over the world's food supply. They won't give up easily. Even the Japanese must come to the supper table sometime. If Monsanto gets the Australian crop, the world is truly doomed. I was hoping that the wheat supply would be spared. I knew about the soybeans. I knew about the corn. Of course, you remember the bees were being killed off by the Roundup Ready pollen that was being picked up by the bees and carried back to the hive. So they had to pull the corn off the market, modify it again, and put it back on the market. Now it's in the wheat. All right. About 6 months ago, we did a special on Agenda 21. It has hit the news again. This is an organization that was originally started by some elites, mostly in the jewelry business and banking business. And they got the idea that if they started seizing properties and preventing it from being fished or being planted, that they could somehow rewild some of these areas. They have an ultimate agenda to drive humans back into mega cities and leave the rest of the world unpopulated by humans. They call it sustainable development. It can't be done if we sprawl. They have to group people together. According to its authors, the objective of sustainable development is to integrate economic, social, and environmental policies in order to achieve reduced consumption, social equity, and the preservation of restoration of biodiversity. In other words, when we're talking about rewilding a planet, we're talking about letting nature go back to nature, letting the whole predator-prey relationship become restored in the forests and in the deserts, and get people out of there, get their neighborhoods out of there, push them into social groups in mega cities, and to reduce the consumption by basically eliminating those that consume too much. Social equity by removing the difference between the ultra wealthy and the ultra poor, and ostensibly push everybody into the middle class, which in reality will actually be the lower class, the worker class. The equity would not exist anymore. You would have a ruler class, a privileged class that would be served by the worker class. Now, sustainabilists insist that every societal decision be based on environmental impact, focusing on three components: global land use, global education, and global population control and reduction. Now, I'm not making this stuff up, Earth Explorers. This is straight off of their website. No, this is not one of the, you know, guess who the Agenda 21 people are. This is right off their website. I want you to think about that just for a moment. Global land use. Well, doesn't that mean that there has to be a global authority that says you can use the land for this and you can't use the land for that? Global education. Doesn't that mean that there's going to be one set of textbooks? There's going to be one history, one mathematics, maybe even possibly one language? Global education. I mean, can't have separate but equal, right? Everything has to be combined into one. And global population control and reduction. All in one sentence, Earth Explorers. Global population control means permitting or having to get a permit to have children. Now, China is already conducting this policy. A family can have two children if one is a boy and or both of them are boys, or one is a boy and one is a girl. As soon as you have a girl, your reproductive rights as a family are removed. Okay? That's how you reduce the population. But we all know mathematically, and we've done this many times, once you get the birth rate below 1.8, that is to say 1.8 children per family, once you get the birth rate below that, you have marked a race for extinction. Cannot survive. It will implode on itself and disappear. So when we're talking about global population control and reduction, we're not talking about maintaining the current population. Be very clear about this. Understand this very carefully. Agenda 21 is about reducing the number of humans on the planet. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to go practice genocide or they're going to finance wars, and through war and attrition, we're going to reduce the world's population, or through the release of some pandemic. You don't have to do that. You don't have to do that. All you have to do is allow some restriction on the way people reproduce. And what that will do is automatically begin to reduce the world's population. And I haven't even gotten into their great agenda. Now, I'm going to do something that I almost never do on this program. I have another host who's on hold right now on line one, and I'm going to let her on the program because I think she has something important to say about this, and we'll just have a good discussion. Lynn, welcome to the program. How are you?
Well, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. Yeah, I'm just really enjoying your... Gosh, after all these years. Anyway, yeah, it's just been really good to connect and listen to other people that are awakening and looking at solutions. But seems like still with the Agenda 21, and you were talking earlier, you know, about the economy and the taxes and blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, we're just in this huge paradigm shift. And we really, because we have the internet, I'm feeling cell phones and what have you at this time, and people like you, thank you, and BVS, that we're able to actually recreate a whole new paradigm, you know, for the planet and override everything with the youth that are here on the planet right now that are waking up. And they are coming in a lot more clear with a lot less baggage. And, of course, the light chips are here, too, to help facilitate. But, you know, it is the economy and jobs. It really comes down to thoughts. You know, if no one's thinking about war, they're thinking about, you know, becoming part of these cities of light, green, helping, healing services, light worker jobs, natural foods, remedies, and we get it out there, what we really want on the planet with all the communication arts and, you know, truth journalisms and virtual interactive programming and just all the beautiful things that we can do, you know, the recycling that's being... Anyway, there's so much we can do to create actually heaven on earth and universal travel, too. So for the overpopulation, and, you know, it really is just changing the money structure.
Lynn, you can see the way things are being set up, though, that the power structure is set up to control the media. That's why BBS Radio is so important, because hosts like you and me, we're out here talking to people, telling people, you don't have to listen to this propaganda line. This Agenda 21 and these words that I just read right off their own website should just make people break out in a cold sweat. And this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, but the truth is there's a whole nother actually paradigm shifters of, you know, in-light radios and, you know, Gaia, the golden age of a Gaia. There's all kinds of BBS people. There's all kinds of body, mind, spirit expo people in every city, Lightworkers International, Healers International. And these are youth. There's a lot of youth waking up and getting involved with energy medicine healers. And it's just really exciting what we can do. The peace groups are just multifaceted, what's coming together online with the peace groups. We've got the spiritual groups. We've got the spiritualists. We've got all the new age groups. We've got even the churches, a lot of them, realize that there can be no more separation. We really have to get all the churches aboard and say, hey, we want these spiritual activist jobs. We want these jobs for people to be of helping, healing, loving, you know, soul purpose developmental programs. And we're growing up on the planet to share and care. Churches, step it up. Let's start a whole new civil services and social services and health and human services. We can do this.
Yeah, you're right. We don't have to have government do everything for us. But as you can see by these elites that have set up Agenda 21, and believe me, this is backed by a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe even in the billions of dollars. They've already succeeded in seizing sections of the ocean, no longer allowed to fish in those areas, to what they say allow fish to come back, you know, the nurseries to come back. They're seizing national park areas and wilderness areas, and they're forbidding human intervention or even trespassing into those areas. Their plan is to push humanity into a group of mega cities that will live and sustain on an equal basis, leaving the rest of the planet unpopulated. But in order for them to do that, they've got to trim the global population by about 2 to 3 billion people. That's their plan.
I know, but that's the why it's really critical to get the youth, all the green movement people that are out there, Dr. Jill Stein, .com, all of her constituents and all of her contacts, all of Oprah's, you know, all of Katrina's, the Hispanic leader, all of the New Earth people here that are awake, and get us organized so that we can start these really light workers armies of New Earth civil services where they are paid. The kids are paid. The churches help this happen, that the youth are paid to be of helping, healing, spiritual workers instead of the drugging, jailing, killing, and policing and, you know, Agenda 21. And there is no reason for Agenda 21. It's a massive universe right now out there, and the light ships are here for people that are worried about overpopulation. Let them go. You know, hey, there's a lot of other planets to go to.
Yeah, I agree with you, and all the underground shelters and everything that have been built. My mindset is, why don't you go ahead and get in them now? Beat the rush. Just go ahead and get in them. Start taking advantage of your food supply, storage of movies, and all your friends will be there. Go ahead and get in them now. Lock the door, and we'll take it from here. What do you say?
Yeah. Or they can go to a retrograde planet and continue their militaristic craziness. Drop them off. The one that's still, you know, back in 3D, way back. So yeah. I just feel like we really are coming forward, and there's so much to do. And it is about organizing. We have the internet. There's so many women's groups now coming forward that are just incredible. And like I said, there's a lot of the peace groups, spiritual groups, new age groups, green groups. We are the 99% that are here in awakening. And it's time for us, you know, to co-create these transformation centers in towns and what have you, enlightenment centers and new earth job training, you know, course, so that, you know, we've got the whole town, all the cities and all the communities interacting locally and globally to recreate this whole planet for heavenly purposes and really get going, because there's really a lot of work to do for, and there's plenty of work for everyone. And people that are taking care of animals, you pay them. They're caretakers. You know, you pay them well, pay everyone free and equally well, so that, you know, money, they really realize that it's really not about money. It's about your soul purpose, personal ascension, and planetary.
Well, I agree with you that there is a disparity between the mega rich and the mega poverty stricken and what we have put value on in our society, and we've exchanged that value for money. Now, what we've said is that a banker or an insurance guy or somebody that brokers a big money deal, he's worth more than somebody who, say, works with, you know, healing or something like that in an inner city or even in a rural setting, that there's really no such thing. I mean, I agree with you. We need to have a different paradigm as far as what we exchange for value in our society. And I'm talking globally. What's the purpose of having a billionaire? What is the purpose of having $1 billion in the bank?
Exactly. Unless you're still working on the old paradigm of the ego-driven power manipulation and control, which is really evil, and we're going into a spiritual activist, you know, coalitions and community services. And it's really critical that people are looking at this and take on that, the actions of our students, our colleges, you know, are being our kids, putting them in debt, but yet, you know, the local malls, they have these recruitment centers for free education, teaching, training, and all these military benefits still hanging there. It's just insane. Or don't they see what's happening? I mean, MLK said anyone who puts more money into defense and social services, any country that does that is dying. Well, wake up, America. America should be leading the way. We should be leading the way. That's
look at the difference between China and America. Now, I'm not trying to defend a communist manner at all, but China has not been at war with anybody in over 50 years. China has not shot a bullet or launched a missile at anyone in over 50 years. Yeah, they're in the business of exporting weapons and war and uniforms and everything else, but they're mostly, the Chinese people are mostly productive trading partners. And look what's happened to their country. They're not even in the arms race.
It's getting all the youth. If we can get all the youth worldwide into these local, global, all these different jobs, and just list them out, you know, teachers, coaches, all the helping healing services, all the nonprofits, services are all paid. Everyone is to be paid of helping healing, caring services that have no harmful side effects. So that we start all the green jobs that are needed and all the body, mind, spirit healers. Why aren't we having body, mind, spirit people everywhere playing music instead of, you know, music therapy instead of drug therapy? I mean, the whole drug paradigm and the vaccination paradigm, I mean, there are trillions in the warring paradigm. I mean, there's no reason for violence. Put kids in sports and pay coaches more. I mean, you know, it's insane. We don't need what's happened. And the fossil fuels, there's millions of beautiful Tesla and green energies and, you know, oh, gosh, you know, we've got the wind, solar. I mean, it's just there's a lot of work to be done, and our kids are waiting for, you know, us to help lead this new revolution, evolution into love. Occupy went to www.occupylove.com, and the planet's going into planetary oneness, knowing that we're all connected, we're all in this together, and we all really need to recreate a whole new civilization of health and human services, social services, and civil services.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that the paradigm is shifting. I think that, you know, what I covered in the first hour about the NSA seizing all of our phone records and, you know, having the ability of building a retroactive case against us by going back and listing every phone conversation we've had with friends or neighbors or whatever, and profiling us and putting us, all that is doomed to failure.
Fear. Yeah, it's fear tactics, more fear. What do you know about the NASARA funding? I've been told, I actually got a petition from the White House about the UFO disclosure right out of the White House to sign to go ahead about a year ago. And then I got one out of the White House about the NASARA funding to activate it. I heard it was in the White House, and it's in Canada, and it's in India. What do you know about it for activating the whole new economy and then letting, you know, of course, the bankers, the top elite, and the Wall Street pay all the extra taxes? What do you know?
Well, I don't think anything like that is happening, not in the White House. I think that there might be an effort to try to take over all of the banks. I've watched what Japan has done in the last 2 months, trying to print its way out of recession. I've watched what our own Fed has done by printing $40 to $80 billion a month to pump up the stock market. I mean, stock market's doing great. Everybody thinks the economy is doing great because they're looking at the Dow. But it sends a chill up my spine when I look at people, intelligent people, people that I respect, who say the economy is doing great. Just look at the stock market. I mean, I think to myself, how stupid can you be? We're sitting here at 20% unemployment in some states. We're at manufacturing levels that we haven't seen since 1968. That's how far we've fallen down.
But we've sure grown our military industrial complex and our penal industrial complex, and even down here in this remote area, they get $6,000 per kid per month, $6,000 per child per month for putting them in a dysfunctional, in these, ranches, so to speak, and all they are is training them to be part of the military industrial complex or policing. Really, that's it's insane. And we're allowing this. I'm just saying, as long as people don't wake up and understand where the money is going and what we could do, and it's money changer time and the possibilities of reorientating it towards a whole new civilization of jobs and focus, intentional thought focus, we're in trouble.
Well, we are. And I don't know that a paradigm shift will do it, because we're a peaceful, cheek-turning people. We're forgiving. We're always looking for the future. We're looking for the good in people and helping it to grow a little bit every day. And they are not. They are looking for world domination, and they have the weapons and the money to make it so.
But the women and children have the power and the internet to make it change, to help it change. Really, we are the 99%. And 75% of this world's population right now, 75% is 35 or younger. So there's lots of hope.
Well, actually, the median age of the United States right now has not seen such a high age since 1949. After World War II, you know, families were very, very small. During World War II, because most of the nation was in poverty. And a lot of men died in conflict and came back with so screwed up in the head they couldn't have normal families. When you see that much carnage, you just can't come back and have a normal family. So it took until the 50s, the actual baby boomers, before the median age began to drop. And it continued to drop until about the year 2000. And now here we are in 2013, back up to a very high median age. And it's alarming to me, because what it's telling me is families are having less and less children because they're right back in the same level of poverty that we were in after World War One.
Oh, no, it's way worse. What the kids have to look forward to in the higher education is no job, in debt, and trillions of dollars of our government And that means related, you know, fear, stress. So how do we cope with it? Oh, more violence, more drugging, more jails. And they've got us. They've got this system going that if they, you know, that's why the NASARA funding really is critical to get out to the masses. It's just money, folks, and it's jobs. It's money and jobs. That's all we have to do. It's that simple. Get a recreation of an economy that works for everyone to, you know, follow their God-given abilities, that sole purpose, developmental programs, and get them, you know, activated, but also grow the gifts, grow the light of each person so we can ascend this friggin' planet.
Well, maybe we need to decentralize everything and quit thinking about global markets and just serve our local communities, our local cities, our local counties, and try to grow it that way and just quit trying to be a global economy, because we get the global stress and we get the global what I call extraction process, which is where global banks are pulling cash out of every small town, no matter how small they are. They're pulling cash out of those communities that can no longer be used in those communities to start or sustain business in those communities.
There's so much we can do. We can even start light cards through ATM programs that if we generate, it's actually the formation of, you know, the real government by the people, for the people, in every city, in every community that's available, that is at a soul level, that's also for the enlightenment purposes of each person's ascension. Joyful child, joy, 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 where's the joy? Joyful children of light, of God. These healing art centers that are prevention intervention, we've got to knock Big Pharma on its rear, too. It's got to be backed off. I mean, there's been, cancer's been healed, you know, on and on. You know the game. So we have all these paradigms that are causing problems and stress and more fear and more problems, and they like that. That's why it's really critical, and I love what you're doing, because you're giving some attitudes and some new inspiration and hope to people that can look at it and go, well, why can't we? Why can't we start this whole new? I mean, if we can do all these jails and military bases everywhere and what have you in schools and take kids out of school, why can't we start these enlightenment teaching training programs in every city? Why can't we have light workers, armies of New Earth civil services, and give them free medical and dental? Do you think anyone will go to war? No, none of the kids will. And if no one's going, there won't be any.
Yeah.
You know, and if we can get the women, I know the women are on this, if we can get these started and put them, these programs for all these green jobs in Israel and Pakistan and Iran immediately and get these new jobs opened up, you watch what happens.
Yeah, there was a day.
All the Chinese kids, the African, I mean, they all want to be of service. Why not light worker services? Why not newer services?
I don't know.
Why not?
I know there used to be a day when doctors and dentists could give free health care, but they can't do that anymore. It's not legal. You can't do that anymore. It all has to be under the system. Listen, I am out of time, Lynn, but it's been a pleasure having you on the program, and be sure to call back.
But they do, Hunt. They do give free medical and dental to military, okay? So it is possible. Okay? Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Lynn.
Interesting. Lots of love. Lots of all light.
All right.
Thank
bye
you.
Bye. We like to have the calls, especially those that are out there that feel the pulse. They know what's going on. They talk to the people, hear from the people, and it's always good to have that energy coming back in. I don't have a lot of time to go back into this Agenda 21, but I'm going to pick it up next week here. You really need to hear this. This is not, I'm telling you, this is not the stuff that you read about Agenda 21. These are things that you learn from Agenda 21's website. So I want to make sure that you get it from them. You hear their words, and then you'll know what's going on. Then you'll know what's being said. So I can just tell you that we have a great organization here at X Squared Radio. We've been on BBS Radio now for 8 years. We consistently are in the top 4 or 5 programs, depending on what host we have. obviously, if I speak for 3 hours, sometimes it doesn't draw a huge audience. But you should listen every week because it's informative. I go through all the news that's important, space news, mystery news. And, yes, we do cover government. We don't get too much into the conspiracy theories. There are other programs that do that. That's not my intention here. My intention here is to keep you informed. So when people throw these words out there like GMO or Agenda 21, you know what they're talking about, and you know from their websites and their information what they're trying to accomplish. I want you to be informed. That's my job here at X Squared Radio. We talk about the mysteries of the universe and of the earth, and we empower our listeners so that they can make informed decisions. It's so much better if you're informed and you know where your politicians stand on these issues. We have hosts on this program that are undergoing discrimination. They're undergoing all kinds of political problems in their own communities, and we don't like to see that happen. We want to see exposure to these higher principles so that you understand what the relationship is between man and man, and man and the earth, and even man and the universe. Just know this: you are source, and you are not alone. You are connected to every living thing on this planet, and much of which has gone extinct. Some of it not through any fault of yours, just because it's a question of sustainability of their own lifestyle, whether they're a microbe, a bird, a fish, or a dinosaur. The conditions on the planet do change. Man is the most adaptable animal. On average, we spend less than 15% of our time outdoors because we're able to build ourselves shelters and keep ourselves safe from the elements. That's part of the mystery of how we survive in the universe. Anyway, we're right here every week between 5 and 8 Pacific, 8 and 11 Eastern Time, X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We'll see you next week right here. Bye-bye.